Measure Up Podcast, Episode 37, Engaging Busy Scientists to Measure the Impact of Research. G'day and welcome. I'm Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com and your host for the Measure Up podcast. I believe performance measurement is the foundation for an organisation to be truly excellent at what it exists to do. And my passion is to make it easy and fun for you to do performance measurement meaningfully and engagingly. Call me a purist, but I always say you should never design measures for others. If a person or team is going to be responsible for achieving a target, or at least improving some aspect of performance, then they should be designing the right measures themselves. Buy-in, or engagement, or ownership, doesn't happen otherwise. But it does mean that people need to give time to doing the measurement activities, and rarely is that time accurately anticipated or even made available. So until measurement truly does become a part of everyone's job, to paraphrase author Dean Spitzer, we need to find ways to engage people without unrealistic demands for their time. This exact challenge faced Paul Barnett on his quest to get scientists to better measure the impact of their research at Australia's national science organisation, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or as it's more widely known, CSIRO. Paul joined me recently for an interview about how he's progressed so far with helping his time-poor CSIRO colleagues to find meaningful measures for their sustainable agriculture flagship.
Well, g'day, this is Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com and creator of the Performance Measurement Methodology, PUMP. I am talking with Paul Barnett today, who is the Impact and Business Development Manager with CSIRO here in Australia. Paul's actually based in Brisbane, and a good part of what he's been up to over the past 18 months or so is setting up good planning and good performance measurement for CSIRO's Sustainable Agriculture Flagship. And the idea with that is to help put more focus and evidence around the impact of research beyond the organisation. So, Paul, firstly, welcome, and would you like to elaborate a little before we start talking about what you've been up to with measurement, and maybe particularly for those people who don't even know what a flagship is, give us a bit of background about that.
Thanks, Stacey. I have to apologise for my voice first up. I'm a little bit unwell, but it's a good radio voice, right? So.
Yeah, that's right. Husky.
What is a flagship? Well, CSIRO has... a number of discipline areas, I guess you could say. So we might have mathematicians in one area, mathematicians and statisticians, and then in another area we have ecologists, and in another area we might have social researchers. And so a flagship is a way of combining those different disciplines and putting them in a program of work that is targeted at a specific goal. And the specific goal for a flagship is always something that has an effect on in society, environment, or the economy, or all three. So for the Sustainable Agriculture Flagship, our goal is to work with our partners and collaborators to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions intensity of agriculture and at the same time increase agricultural productivity. So I guess... yeah, a flagship is just a mission-directed, goal-oriented beast. And what my role over the last year and a half has been is to really work out, okay, you know, not so much how's our performance within the organisation, but how is our performance outside the organisation? What are the things that we're accountable for? How are we going with those? We're looking to see, you know, what is the impact outside CSIRO and how can we improve our performance delivering into that.
Kind of big picture thinking. So, Paul, we met a while ago when you went through the Blueprint program. What was the context or the background or the trigger that got you going out there seeking some kind of an approach to do performance measurement?
Yeah, look, I guess CSIRO's, being a mission-directed organisation, has always been focused on impact, and it's been a transformation over the last sort of decade that it's really come to be the primary thing that CSIRO is aimed at. But we've been managing our impact in an intuitive manner. We've been managing it without the rigor of in terms of planning, you know, how do we plan the impact that we're going to have outside the organisation? We've typically, as many science organisations have done in the past, focused on more the, you know, what are the research outputs that we need to generate, and less on how do we make sure that they're in such a form and a way that can be translated into real effects outside the organisation. So I guess the reason why we sought out the Pump Blueprint program was to add some rigor to that planning process and then be able to monitor against the plan. And I think that's where we started. So that was a good place to start.
Kind of makes sense that a science and research based organisation would try to take a more deliberate or rigorous approach to its planning rather than purely intuitive. It kind of doesn't fit with the culture to be purely intuitive, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'll make it clear that the science planning has always been there. And the planning around delivery of impact has kind of been there, but it's the systems to support that culture and support it, you know, to add the capability as a foundational component of how we manage, rather than a more intuitive approach that many talented people do very, very well, but without the support of a system. So I guess, yeah, being more systematic about it is what we've tried to do, yeah.
How did you get started with the performance measurement process with using PUMP? I guess what started happening 18 months ago, roughly?
Yeah, well, I came to do the course with a few other people from CSIRO, the Blueprint program, and as a result of that, I came back to the office and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to just try and roll this out in CSIRO, in my part of the organisation, and just see how we can adapt it to this. I guess it's a little bit different than most organisations. We're trying to look at processes outside the organisation, largely outside of our sphere of influence. So we started by just trying results mapping. And so we've got four units of work within the flagship, which we call themes, and we did one results map for each of those. We actually, to fit with CSIRO terminology, we've called an outcome mapping. So as you'd know, there's a lot of language that gets in the way of when you're trying to do some organisational change, right? There's language is kind of the first thing that hits you in the face, and until you've got that sorted out, it's quite difficult to move forward. So, one of the, you know, as doing in doing results mapping, we learnt that was a tricky thing, and we actually started to just focus in on, okay, well, let's get our language sorted, and then we can start doing some results mapping. And build on the language and engagement through that process. So we used that group environment to sort of build a common understanding of what we were here to do, what language we were using, and how we were going to use it. And it sort of really developed its own sort of rigor of what each of the layers in the results map means as well. So you know, we've kind of worked down a path now where, you know, being scientists, they're pretty interested in what everything means and the details of how things fit together, and that, you know, if you can't just present a system and not have any rigor behind it. So that came pretty quickly. Once we'd done our results mapping, we sort of moved into a phase of designing the measures and doing the definitions as well. And we, because of the limited resources that we have to throw at this in terms of catalyzing resources, I'm pretty much half of my time goes to this in a $65 million business. So I have to try and pull in other people as we go and try and get them interested in doing workshops to do results mapping or doing developing measures, measure designs and definitions. So in order to kind of get around that resource limitation, I took the leader of each of the themes, and we worked as a pair on draft measure designs and definitions for each of the outermost bubbles on the results map. And the reason we chose just the outermost bubbles to start with is because they're the things that are that CSIRO is directly engaged in. So, as we move further in towards our ultimate goal, which might be 20 or 30 years away, a social, environmental, or economic, effect or result, it's easy to develop measures about those things, but it's harder to show the attribution to CSIRO. We can show our contribution, and so that's a very important concept to us was about learning that we need to talk about contribution, not attribution. So our contribution is actually on those outer bubbles. So we've been developing those, and then the next step from that is that we're also going through at the moment, and it's been quite successful, is to take those draft measure designs and definitions and talk with the broader team about, basically give them something to discuss and debate and tear apart, rather than coming with a blank sheet. And that's been successful, and it earns some respect as well that, there's some commitment in this from someone else. I'm not just coming with blank forms and asking you to fill them out. And, we're trying to engender this sort of commitment rather than compliance. and that's been really good.
That's a really important point to sort of dwell on for a moment, I think, Paul, because as you would know, I would be saying to people, take these measure design templates and sit down with the people who own the results and collaborate to, facilitate them to design their own measures. But like you say, that's not going to work in every situation. So what was it about your situation that made it more successful for you to do some groundwork first and take the groundwork to them? Because in some organisations that wouldn't work. People would feel like they were being backed into a corner in a sense. So it's a cultural difference, I'm imagining.
Yeah, I think it's let me think about it. There's a culture of I guess, we do research and we focus on research and some of the other administrative tasks are seen as, being a distraction, to be honest. And that, I don't think that's probably too different in a lot of organisations. But I guess trying to engage in a way that respects focusing on, what's in it for me, for each of the groups that you're engaging with has been really important. So I guess what the approach has been in every engagement has been that we just focus on making sure that there's some value being derived by the participant through engaging in that process at that point in time and, with a promise of some other benefit in the future. There's a bit of a, everybody's time poor, and to come with something is a bit of a olive branch to say, hey, we've had a go, it's been informed by your theme leader, but now, you can tear this apart and provide something else. But if, you know, but if you think it's okay and you give it a tick, and then, you know, we can just discuss and debate the details of how, you know, I guess what it, how it is actually going to be rolled out, then you still manage to get buy-in, but it's a bit of a shortcut, I think.
That sounds great. So, Paul, are you happy to give us some examples of some of the results, or in your language, outcomes that were relevant for your flagship, and or for a particular theme, and maybe some of the measures that you ended up starting to work on?
Yeah, sure. I'll probably just take us to the greenhouse gas theme. We have a theme that's focused on greenhouse gas and carbon sequestration in the agricultural landscape. So one of the things that they've identified as being the three core results in the middle of the results map are that land managers are abating greenhouse gas. So that means that they're they're reducing their emissions,
mm-hmm.
And that they're sequestering carbon into the landscape that might be in their soil or something like that. The second core result is that greenhouse gas abatement actions produce co-benefits. So that means that not only do you sequester carbon in your soil, but there's some other benefit that might be environmental or social that is gained at the same time. So if we think about soil carbon, another benefit of that would be that there's an economic benefit, one thing, because perhaps the soil is healthier, so yeah. It produces better crops, and so that's that. Environmentally, there's the soil biology is better, so there might be a better ecosystem around the soil ecosystem, and it might also mean that the soil is more stable, for example. So there's, and then socially, that, you know, you could think about that economic benefit leading on to better rural livelihoods because it's more profitable to manage better soils. So all that's the premise on that one. Okay, and then the third result around that theme is that Australia chooses the lowest cost and least risk greenhouse gas abatement pathway. So that's a tricky one, but that basically means that Australia chooses a pathway to greenhouse gas abatement that doesn't cost us a lot of money to do so. So some of that's around how do we identify the carbon stores in our landscapes that are at risk, and how do we better manage them so that they don't this might be around management of savannas and savanna burning of grasslands, or it could be, or we could also think about actually the how Australia reports to the various or the treaties that we're involved in about our greenhouse gas emissions. And what that means for our activities on the ground that need to change in certain ways. It's a tricky one, that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of systems thinking involved in those three outcomes at that yeah. highest level, by the sound of it, and some really sophisticated yeah. thinking too, which is very interesting. So how about yeah. measures for those things? Are they hard to measure?
They're very – well, actually, I mean – If you pick one, land managers are abating greenhouse gas, it's actually not that hard to measure because there's through the Carbon Farming Initiative, there will be credits and through a carbon trading system, there will be credits that land managers can register when they have a carbon store, for example. And so that'll be accounted, and the information about those credits will be known. So we can actually know how much carbon has been sequestered because it's basically going to be part of the financial system. So we have to have pretty good checks and balances. The trick is then that that actually what is CSIRO's contribution to that? And that's why we're actually working harder on the measure definitions and designs around the things further down the system or further down the influence chain or cause effect chain at the outside.
In other words,
the
outside layer of the outcomes map, exactly.
Exactly, yeah. So one of the things there is because there's also government there's government or policy pathways, impact pathways that we think of. So an impact pathway is how does our knowledge get translated and used to make a difference. And if you think about a policy pathway, that's a government, what decisions can government make on the basis of scientific knowledge that's presented to them to make a change in the real world. The policy pathways we think about, the first thing there is that CSIRO, and I'm reading from a result now, CSIRO is a preferred and trusted advisor of government and industry. So that means that government actually comes to us and says, hey, or industry comes to us and says, hey, we trust you because of the rigour of your process and the rigour of your science. We would like you to tell us something that requires some research or requires some scientific knowledge so that we can, you know, use that knowledge to do something differently ourselves. And so, you know, we think that the most critical point of why a government or industry representative would come to us to do that is because they trust us. A measure, I'm just flicking through to the measure design there now.
That would be great to hear a couple of those.
So the basically we've got two that relate to that we're working through. And so these aren't final, but it's number one of them's the number of invitations to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is the number and quality of contributions. So you can see the difference in those two. One of them sort of is just it's really an output measure, you know, what have we contributed? And the second one is trying to get a bit more at the quality of the contributions. And so how was the contribution received? Was the contribution one of 100 submissions to government that was maybe, you know, considered in a broader group? Or was it, for example, an invitation to participate in a one-on-one meeting? And how does that, you know, what was the quality of the exchange?
You mentioned to me, Paul, earlier that you did your measure designs and your measure definitions very close together. So when you had designed some measures, in other words, you had an outcome, you wanted to figure out how you'd measure it, and you worked out your first thoughts about what the best measure would be, you then would go into that stage of defining that measure, fleshing out how it's calculated and what data you'd need. Mm. Just by that example you gave there, it sounds like that would have been a very useful thing to do, to flesh out the detail of something like the quality of contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's the thing is that actually when we went to the definition phase, having a look at the strength of the relationship between the measure and the result, mm-hmm. and the feasibility is pretty much the defining factor. When you work through the design phase and then you list the possible measures, and then you have a look at the strength of the relationship with the result and the feasibility of carrying out the measure, it very quickly comes down to a choice of resources. How much time or money can you spend on collecting that measure? And you have to, it's, you know, have to basically make a decision about quality. Can we afford that, the quality measure, or do we just have to go with the cheaper one and analyse it with that in mind?
They're important considerations to make, and I haven't heard of too many people at all doing the measure design step and the measure definition step so close together before that I totally can understand the merits of it in the way you've described it. So, Paul, is there anything else that you want to share about, how you've been going about doing the performance measurement? Because there is, I would like to dig in just a little bit more deeply into how you got people engaged along the way.
Yeah, I think I'd probably come back to that thing about making sure that there's value for the participant. That's in everything. I guess I fundamentally believe that work's pretty voluntary. People, people have to come to work if they want to get paid, but there's maybe that's a reflection of our organisation. I'm not sure, but to get people interested in doing something, because there's so many demands on people's time, it really has to show value to them in their job, in what they're trying to achieve. And so I guess it just comes back to that time and time again. You can come up with the best process, and which is entirely, the most rigorous and right way to do things. But unless people can see value in their participation in it, you'll get that, you'll get compliance, not commitment. And commitment is what we're after, so that people do it with passion.
Yeah.
And they actually end up with something that they can use in their job, and they do go and use it. And that's where, we could think about for myself, what impact am I having? If it stops with the meeting that I've had and the output that I've got from them in terms of a measure design or a definition, then I've really failed, because there's no multiplier on what I'm doing. It's actually just, whatever I'm doing. So I think, that commitment engenders I can see how I'll use this in my other work, or how I'll be able to use this to design the next project, or how I'll use this to be more effective, be more successful in such and such an application. And so the relevance and value is really important.
So there's a few buy-in strategies that you've really talked about. That one just now about making sure that there's a WIFM, a what's in it for me, for the people that you're involving. And also you talked about trying to save their time by doing some pre-work in advance. There was one that was kind of implied. I don't know that you put it up directly as a buy-in strategy, but this idea that what you take to them is open for not just discussion. You're not just taking it to them to sign off on it. You're taking it to them, and in your words, for them to tear it apart if they need to, which is, that invitation is a very real one. So are they sound like some great ways to get the buy-in.
Yeah, sure. I think... If you go with the approach that you're interested in getting the form filled out, then you're going to get the form filled out, and it won't be very effective. But we do approach it in that way, that here's an attempt, and because you're scientists, in inverted commas, they're trained skeptics, right? That's what they do for a living, is pull things apart and challenge them. And so this is the environment we work in. So it would be foolish of me to expect that the science, there's a science of performance measurement. There is fundamentally a science that sits underneath how these processes, how you've link together these different processes. We need to recognise that, and then actually just make sure that we give credence to someone who's got some experience. We have researchers in the that have been part of these processes that for a living look at these causal pathways in social change and how to design processes to engage communities in things and get their participatory projects working. I think that's a real benefit to the way that we've had to do it in my part of the world, because that brings their expertise on board. and exposes, you know, exposes the process to some questioning, and that generates the ownership itself just by being part of the design of the process. So,
indeed.
Yeah.
So what have?
Sorry, go on.
I was going to ask you another question, Paul, but if you haven't finished, please do.
No, I think I was rambling. I'm sorry. I'm
No, you're doing really well for someone who's not feeling very well. and enjoying the voice too, the husky voice. So, Paul, what's been accomplished so far? Like, has the journey been worth it up to this point? I know you're still not done. There's more to do.
Yeah, look, it has been put to me about, where's the product? At the early stage, when we'd been doing some results mapping and we came up with some pretty kind of diagrams and things, where's the product? What have you achieved? And that's an interesting question, because it immediately makes you think, okay, well, how do I describe the value that we've gotten by going through this process? And I think there's, I'll put it this way, that the major accomplishment is taking as we said earlier about the intuition approach. Mm-hmm. We take what's in people's heads that they use intuitive kind of results maps that they've actually got embedded in their heads, and we put it on paper, and we get that we enable a discourse between the different heads that wasn't enabled before in such a systematic way. And through doing that, we surface any tension points between the different results maps that are in people's heads. And that in and of itself creates a huge amount of value just by getting people to be aligned and allowing them to have a forum where they can discuss and debate the merits of different impact pathways, and their understand, they bring the understanding and value from different parts of the system into one representation, which they can share. So, as a result of that, people are thinking differently. They look at the world a little bit differently, and so that's been really great, it's really given, if we think about that as the thought leaders going through that process, then you think about the people who are working in projects, and they've actually been able to, where they've been engaged in the process, have been able to grasp their role in this broader goal. You know, they've been able to link what they're doing on a day-to-day basis to the flagship goal of this enterprise that they're a part of. At least for me, that would be liberating, to say, okay, well, I can see the value that I'm delivering into this bigger thing, and I'm a part of it. That's actually been really, really quite good. So I'm talking about kind of pretty fuzzy kind of fluffy things here, I guess, rather than, we produced this product and this product, which we did, and they're extremely valuable for communication and engagement with clients and so forth. But a lot of the value and a lot of the reasoning for why it's been worth it, it really comes back to those things about engagement and sharing and that sort of thing.
And converging on that shared model of the world, or at least the part of the world that you're impacting through your actions.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Often, Paul, people will say, when I'm facilitating a results mapping session, is, God, this is taking longer than I thought, but geez, it's a conversation we should have had years ago. And I think that's what they're meaning. Finally we're able to share our view of the world and fine-tune it and adjust it slightly so that we all share that same thing that we're pursuing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's actually, that's exactly it. They don't get an opportunity to do it unless you schedule it. And make time for it and do it systematically. So,
indeed.
I think that's really a big benefit.
So what's some of the wisdom, maybe a couple of one, two, or maybe three really important, I don't think messages is quite the right word, but little pearls of wisdom that you have developed over this time that you've been working with performance measures for this sustainable agriculture flagship.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't say that there's any wisdom necessarily generated in my head as a result. If I can talk about what's new to me and what has been really good for me to learn, that's probably better. I think we've kind of brushed up against this in the discussion. Has been about what that it's more than a process, and that for an organisation that's going in a new direction, I guess around being more rigorous in performance evaluation in this area. We've always had performance evaluation in the core research space. It's been that it's more than a process. It's organisational change. And so if your organisation is not used to performance management and hasn't in the past been doing a lot of that, and I don't know how many of your listeners will be in that boat, but organisational change brings with it these things that I guess we think about it in four key ways, and the systems is actually the last one. So the systems and processes is the last one. Before that, there needs to be a culture that is focused on performance and focused on excellence of performance. And before that, they need to have the capability, right? They need to be able to, they need to have the language to discuss. They need to have the forums and the venues to be able to have the discourse. And on top of that, we need a leadership that has bought in visibly and is modelling the performance excellence behaviour, so that it can be seen that okay, look, the leadership's right there on this. This is important, and we've got a culture that all of the people around me think this is important. I can be better, then I'm going to engage in it. So I think that's the pump process deals with that quite explicitly in one way, but subtly if you weren't thinking about it. So, talking about how to get buy-in and who's in the, thinking about who's in the room and so forth. That's how you make it work. It's not just a process.
I always talk about balancing the technical and the social side of performance measurement, because it's very easy to forget that the social side of performance measurement isn't something that we should just be complaining about. It's something we can influence. It's something that we can even exploit to some extent to get people,
exactly,
more focused on those shared outcomes. So, Paul, we're running really close to the end of time. I'm not sure how much time you've got left, but one of my final questions, my final question to you was going to be, where to next? You may answer that as briefly as you wish, given your time constraint.
Oh, sure. One of the things that is striking for me at the moment is that we are working in a space that involves a lot of different organisations. They're all interested in the performance evaluation of their core business and what's happening around them and how they can influence the organisations around them. So that we can describe that as the innovation system. And so to do justice to these impact pathways that we're trying to map on in a results map format, we need to know how others are performing and how changes down that cause effect linkage. How are they going, and how does how they're going affect the kind of research outputs that we produce? So how do we produce a technology that actually recognises some variation further down the track that means, we produce the right technology or the right piece of information or the right knowledge that's relevant to them? And so if you think about it then, each organisation at different parts of the innovation system are thinking about measuring different things and so forth. We've really got to get our act together and start sharing that information a lot more freely, so that we can all know where where we're at in our journey in the context of others, the other journeys that are going on at the same time. So that presents a real problem in information management. So, you know, if I'm going to give you a spreadsheet of my survey responses to such and such, then how do you know in what way the question was asked, or what the constraints were, or what the terms actually mean? You know, if the definitions are very difficult and language is a problem for us within a single organisation, what's it going to be like across organisations? So you have all these issues that mean that data collected in one part of the system may actually not be very relevant, maybe very relevant but not usable. And so we're actually thinking about now, how do we set up information protocols and transfer standards and system standards to enable the business objectives of improving impact performance. So there's a start there. The International Aid Transparency Initiative is already looking at some of this, and they're looking at it in particularly around getting that together for the aid agencies and development agencies. We're actually going to go and visit them later in the year and talk to them about how we can broaden that out with some of our experts in information infrastructure and informatics. So that'd be quite interesting.
Very interesting, very exciting too. It'd be lovely to hear about how that comes off in the end. Paul, thank you so much for your time in sharing this with us. And I want to thank everyone for listening in too. And I'm sure, just like me, you've picked up just how strong a systems thinker that Paul is, and likely his colleagues as well. Just the way they think about these cause-effect chains or impact pathways, about linking the work they do each day to the outcomes that they're having as an organisation in the broader world, and how much they're thinking about the interconnection between the different results that they're contributing to, and the interconnections between the different groups of people that are trying to contribute to and impact on those results. So that systems thinking theme has come through so strongly today, and it's really exciting because that is a level of sophistication in performance management that not many people get to, let alone aspire to. So, Paul, thank you again for joining us. It's been wonderful to catch up with you and hear your story.
Thanks, Stacey. Absolute pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again.
No matter how great our performance measurement techniques are, if they don't allow us the flexibility to engage people in different ways, but to still engage them authentically, then what good are they? I really like what the ultramarathon runners say, you know, those people who run distances of 100 miles or more. Ultra running is 90% mental, and the other 10% is mental. Now, performance measurement is a bit like that. Even though we know it has a technical dimension to it, you know, steps to follow and the like, everything about implementing it has a social dimension. You can't make forward progress by having the most sophisticated measurement process but no buy-in. But you can definitely make forward progress with a less than perfect measurement process that builds buy-in. Remember, you can download these podcasts and also heaps of practical articles at measureupblog.com. And you can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes. Just search for Measure Up. If you're a regular listener, I'd love for you to give the show a ranking and give us a little comment at iTunes as well. But until next time, this is Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist, signing off. Keep measuring what matters and engaging everyone you can to do the same.